Okay, so today is November 21st, 2015. Okay, so we'll start with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, so today we're going to be taking sutta number 142 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Dakina Vibhanga Sutta. We are on page 1102. So the Dakina Vibhanga Sutta, which is translated here is the exposition of offerings. But again, I think Vibhanga is best understood as analysis, making divisions. And so we could say the analysis of offerings. And here the key word is the word in the title, dakina, which suggests something more than just giving a gift. But dakina, the idea of dakina, I think it originated, in pre-Buddhist times, amongst the Brahmins, and it's the idea of gifts that are given, particularly in sacrifice, in order to acquire merits. And so the idea that prevailed amongst the old ideal that prevails in the Vedas is that the way to acquire merits is by making sacrifices, and these would be sacrifices of grain from the harvest, and even amongst the Brahmins, the early Brahmins, of animals, so animal sacrifices. And the Buddha distinctly rejects the idea of animal sacrifices as a way of acquiring merit, and he even dismisses the idea of making sacrifices of things that are like grain and fruits. And he redefines the idea of sacrifice in terms of making offerings to those who are considered spiritually worthy, as a way of generating merit. I'll come back to the idea of merit here, but I just wanted to pick up one sutta which shows the contrast between the old idea of sacrifice, the way it was understood in Brahmanism, and the way the Buddha has taken these terms and given a new slant to them, or portray them from a different perspective. Okay, this comes from the Samyutta Nikaya, the connected discourses of the Buddha. It's in the Kosala Samyutta. These are the discourses given to the king of Kosala. And so it's said that at the time the sutta takes place, the king Pasenadi of Kosala had been making arrangements for a great sacrifice, in which 500 bulls, 500 different kinds of cows, 500 goats and so on had been set up for the sacrifice. Okay, then the monks observe this when they go on their alms round and they report it to the Buddha. And then the Buddha says that, he speaks in verse here, and he says that the horse sacrifice, human sacrifice, and he mentions some other sacrifices, these sacrifices fraught with violence do not bring great fruit. The great rishis or seers of right conduct do not attend that sacrifice where animals of various kinds are slain. But those sacrifices free from violence, where no animals are slain, the great rishis attend a sacrifice like this. So a wise person should offer this, a sacrifice bringing great fruit. For one who makes such sacrifice, it is indeed better, never worse. Such a sacrifice is truly vast, and the deities too are pleased. Actually, the sutta doesn't mention expressly what kind of sacrifice is intended here. But what the Buddha intends from other suttas, we know that it would be a great alms offering, an offering of alms, particularly to the Sangha, to the order of monks and nuns. Okay, so we have the concept of dakina here, which means an offering which is given with the intention of generating merit. And so now this brings me to the word merit, which is rendering into English of the Pali word punya. Of Sanskrit, punya. And what lies behind the concept of merit is the idea that as we move from life to life within samsara, our destiny is determined by our karma. And karma is distinguished into two broad categories of unwholesome karma and wholesome karma. Unwholesome karma is action that is motivated by the bad roots of greed, hatred, and ignorance. And wholesome karma is good karma, actions that are motivated by the three good roots of generosity, kindness, and wisdom or understanding. Okay, as we move from samsara, or as we move from life to life within samsara, until one reaches final liberation, it's important to establish the conditions for meeting with what I would call good fortune in one's future existences. By good fortune, I would mean birth into a country in which there are relatively peaceful conditions, a relative degree of material prosperity, conditions such as one can obtain a good education, prospects for employment, smooth and fulfilling personal relationships. So these are some of the fruits the mundane fruits of good karma. And the good karma that secures these fruits, considered from the perspective of its capacity to produce these fruits, is what is called merit. I don't quite like the English word merit, because it suggests that, you know, that there's somebody standing there with the scoreboard, which is, who is going, okay, he gave it here, to that monk, he gets 1 point. They help to mitigate a conflict between those people, he gets 2. Okay, he did that good deed, 4 or 5. So it's like, you get the picture of like scoring up, making a score, or putting money into a bank account. But we could consider merit as formations that are created within the stream of consciousness, karmic formations, which have a potency to come to fruition, first at the mundane level, by producing desirable results as one moves from one existence to another existence. But merit is also considered not only to be the basis for good fortune at a mundane level within the round of rebirths, but merit is also considered to be one of the primary supports for liberation, for realization and liberation. And so in order to be able to advance, you know, through one's spiritual practice up to the level where one is, can attain the meditative absorptions, the stages of insight, the stages of penetration and realization, the paths, what are called the paths and fruits of realization, one needs an accumulation of merit. And sometimes it's said that the two sort of main supports for liberation, for awakening or enlightenment, we speak about the accumulation of merit. Oh, don't interrupt this. The accumulation of merit and the accumulation of wisdom or understanding. And so through certain practices, we could say have an emphasis, within certain practices, there's an emphasis on generating merit and building up a store of merit. Whereas other practices, the emphasis is on building up one's understanding, one's wisdom, one's knowledge. And there's a tendency within, I have to say, within Western Buddhism, to dismiss the idea of merit, like one thinks, like, I don't need merit, I don't want merit, that's just something for people with worldly ambitions. But the Buddha puts a lot of emphasis, you can see, what, especially in his discourses to lay people, on acquiring merits in this life. One sees this repeatedly in the connected discourses to the king of Kosala that I just referred to. For example, King Pasenadi of Kosala comes to the blessed, to the Buddha, and he says, Bhante, while I was alone in seclusion, I thought, who treat themselves as dear and who treat themselves as a foe? Then the Buddha says, those who engage in misconduct by body, speech, and mind treat themselves as a foe, as an enemy. Whereas those who engage in good conduct of body, speech, and mind treat themselves as dear, as a friend. And then he says in the verses, he says, both the merits and the evil that a person does right here, this is what is truly one's own. This is what one takes when one goes, when one passes on. This is what follows one along like a shadow that never departs. Therefore, one should do what is good here and now as a collection for the future life. Merits are the support for living beings when they arise in the other world. So this is, I would say, a very important idea. And this couplet that merits are the support for living beings when they arise in the other world, this couplet appears again and again in the suttas. And so the word, I think the word, Pali word is patita. It's a foundation, a basis on which one stands. So in order to stand securely as one goes from life to life, it's important to perform meritorious deeds. Okay, so now let's go into the sutta itself. Okay, so the sutta takes place when the Buddha has been living in the Sakyan country at the capital of Kapilavastu. And this was the Buddha's own native land. And Kapilavastu, or Sanskrit Kapilavastu, this was the city in which the Buddha was born and grew up. Okay, then on this occasion, Mahaprajapati Gotami took a new, I'm reading from the text now, took a new pair of clothes and went to the Buddha. And then after paying homage to him, then she said to the Blessed One, she said, "This new pair of clothes has been spun by me, woven by me, especially for the Blessed One. Let the Blessed One accept it from me out of compassion." Okay, so the sutta introduces, right after the opening line, it introduces a person who is known by the name of Mahaprajapati Gotami. And who is Mahaprajapati Gotami? Okay, the Buddha, first, the Buddha's father was named King Suddhodana. And King Suddhodana, this is the legend. The Sakyan state was actually not a monarchy. It didn't have a king, but it was a kind of aristocratic republic. And so the Sakyans were an aristocratic clan. And Suddhodana might have been like the president of the council. Later tradition, in order to sort of glorify the Buddha, turns the Sakyan state into a kingship with Suddhodana as the king, a mighty king, and Siddhartha, his son, who's to become the Buddha, as the designated prince. What's the name for the prince who's designated to become the king?
Heir apparent.
The heir to the throne. And so then we have the Buddha renouncing the throne in order to become a wandering ascetic. Okay, so we say that King Suddhodana was probably a member of the ruling council of the Sakyans. Perhaps he was the president of the council, but not a king. Okay, Suddhodana had two chief wives. One of them, the one who was actually probably his first chief wife, was named Maya, and the other was Mahaprajapati Gotami. And Maya was the mother of Siddhartha, who becomes the Buddha. But according to all traditions, Maya died 7 days after Siddhartha was born. And then she was reborn, according to the text, in the Tusita heaven, one of the sense-sphere heavenly realms. Okay, so here's Suddhodana, his chief wife passes away. Who's going to bring up the little baby who's just 7 days old, from infancy up through the time he reaches maturity? So that responsibility devolves on Mahaprajapati Gotami. And so she becomes bound to Siddhartha, the Buddha, by two relationships. Okay, even if Maya had lived, she would still be the aunt of Siddhartha. But because Maya passed away, she also takes on the responsibility of being the foster mother of the infant Siddhartha. And now there's something else interesting about Mahaprajapati Gotami that reflects on this sutta here. Does anybody here know what else is interesting and important about Mahaprajapati Gotami?
She would be the founder or the first bhikkhu?
Exactly. But after the passing away of Suddhodana, up to that time, according to the tradition, there were no bhikkhunis, no ordained Buddhist nuns. And so she was the one who led, we call it a women's rights movement, together with 500, this is a traditional number, 500 Sakyan women, came to the Buddha and pleaded with him, "Bhante, please allow the going forth, the ordination of women, into the Dhamma and Vinaya, into the teaching of the Buddha." And what was the Buddha's response? "Don't ask." Second time she asks, third time she asks, no. Then the Buddha, together with the monks, they leave Kapalabhattu and they go to a city in the south called Vaisali. And Mahaprajapati and the 500 Sakyan women, they shave their heads, they put on ochre-colored robes, and they walk down from Kapalabhattu to Vaisali, and again they come to the Buddha and appeal to him three times, "Please allow women to go forth into the homeless life." Buddha, no. Why does the Buddha refuse? In my opinion, it's not that the Buddha is a sexist and wants to exclude women in principle. What are you doing?
I see Pina here.
Excuse me?
Pina.
In fact, this whole passage is rather controversial, and I have some questions about its authenticity. It's being recorded, okay. I have questions about its authenticity. But this is the way the texts have come down, whether they are authentic or not, that we have to look at critically. Okay, so Mahaprajapati, together with the 500 Sakyan women, come down to Vaisali, ask him three times, again for permission for women to go forth into the homeless life. The Buddha declines. Then they come out from the Buddha's cottage, They're standing on the road. They're still dusty from the journey, looking very gloomy. And who comes walking along but Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's personal attendant. And Ananda asks them, why are you so gloomy and you have tears in your eyes? And Mahaprajapati Gotami explains to him what has taken place. And then Ananda says, you just wait out here. I'll take care of it. Then Ananda comes in and sees the Buddha, and he makes the request, I think again three times. The Buddha says, don't ask Ananda for women to go forth into the homeless life. Then Ananda uses an indirect method. He says, if women go forth, would they be able to achieve the fruit of stream entry, once returning, non-returning? Of course, all of those fruits are accessible to lay people, and their Buddha would have had many lay women disciples who had reached those stages of realization. Then he asked, would women be able to achieve the fruit of arahatship, that is, the fourth stage, the stage of full liberation? And the Buddha says, they can, they would. Then Ananda says, now he's got like one argument down. Then he comes up with a second argument, that Mahaprajapati was so helpful to the Blessed One. When your mother died, she was the one who took care of you. You drank her breast milk. She brought you up just like her own flesh and blood son. So she was so helpful to you. Shouldn't you help her in return? Okay, with those two arguments, the Buddha then laid down eight conditions, and he said, if let me call her Gotami so I don't have to say the mouthful every time. If Gotami will accept these eight conditions, that will count as her ordination. In other words, she will become a nun, a fully ordained nun. Then Ananda went to Mahaprajapati Gotami and told her the eight conditions, and she accepted, and thereby she became the first bhikkhuni. And that started, that was the start, the beginning of the bhikkhuni sangha. At this point in her biography, it seems to me pretty clear that she is not yet a bhikkhuni, because I think the key here, the clue here, is that she says that this new pair of cloths has been spun by me, woven by me, especially for the Blessed One. And now if she was a fully ordained bhikkhuni, I just don't see her spending her time, these are spinning and weaving cloths, you know, sewing together pieces of cloth in order to make a robe. I could say a bhikkhuni might be doing that and offering it to the Buddha. But the spinning of cloth is a laborious process that requires, I mean, I don't have personal experience with it. Does anybody have personal experience spinning cloth? You do. It's a laborious process, isn't it?
Yes, and I used to demonstrate it at Van Cortlandt Manor, and it takes a long time.
Did you have an electric machine to do it? You did it with
foot action.
Yeah, so it's a laborious process. So I just don't see Mahaprajapati Gotami with her nun's robe sitting there at the machine, you know, spinning cloth. But there is, as we'll see, there is an anachronism in the sutta, which I said earlier, raises in my mind some suspicion about the chronology of the sutta. Okay, so the Buddha, when she offers this pair of cloths to the Buddha says, give it to the Sangha, Gotami. When you give it to the Sangha, both I and the Sangha will be honored. Yeah, then there's a note here that says that the Buddha asked her to give the gift to the Sangha because he wanted her volition of generosity to be directed both to the Sangha and to himself, as the combined volition would yield merit leading to her welfare and happiness for a long time. He also said this so that later generations would be inspired to show respect towards the Sangha, and by supporting the Sangha with the requisites, the material requisites, would contribute to the long life of the teaching. Okay, so when the Buddha says this, and let me just elaborate a little on this note, that it uses the expression, the volition of generosity. And this is the decisive factor in the generation of karma, is the volition, or the intention. The word that's used in Pali is the word chetana. So it's the volition, the intention, that governs, you could say, or determines the nature of an action. And so, for example, if I'm walking down a path and I step on an ant or an insect and I have no intention of doing so, then there's no volition behind that action. And so it doesn't create any unwholesome karma. Okay, when I give a gift to somebody, what creates the karma is not simply the transference of one object from my own possession to another, but it's the volition that motivates that gift. So in this case, according to the explanation, the commentary, the Buddha wanted Gotami to generate that volition of giving the cloths, making the cloths, offering the cloths to both the Buddha and the Sangha. Of course, if it's a pair of cloths, that raises the question, what's going to happen to the cloths? Because a pair of cloths, suppose there are 50 monks sitting there, a pair of cloths can't be distributed amongst 50 monks. But I think the decisive factor is that the intention, the volition of Gotami would be to offer the cloths both to the Buddha and the Sangha, and then the Sangha would make the decision, how are we going to distribute these cloths? Okay, so this exchange goes on three times. Okay, now Ananda again inserts himself into the conversation and he appeals to the Buddha. He says, let the Blessed One accept the new pair of cloths from Mahaprajapati Gotami. She has been very helpful to the Blessed One. As his mother's sister, she was his nurse, his wet nurse, his foster mother, who gave him milk. Again, this is very much the same kind of argument that Ananda used when he was appealing to the Buddha to allow the ordination of women. So she took care of the Buddha when your own mother died. Okay, then he says, Ananda says, that the Blessed One too has been very helpful to Mahaprajapati Gotami. And I checked my friend, Venerable Analeo, has a book in which he has a study, comparative study, of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya with their counterparts from other traditions, particularly the Chinese Agama traditions. And he says that in the Chinese and Tibetan parallels to the sutta, it's Ananda who points out that Gotami has been very helpful to the Buddha, but it is the Buddha who then says, I have been very helpful to Gotami. So that's the Chinese and Tibetan versions, whereas in the Pali version, it's Ananda who points out how the Buddha has been very helpful to Gotami. Okay, and then he mentions a number of ways in which the Buddha has been very helpful to Gotami. So he says that it is owing to the Blessed One that Mahaprajapati Gotami has gone for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. It is owing to the Blessed One that Gotami abstains from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, false speech, and the use of intoxicants. Okay, so these are, we call these the first two steps in adopting the Buddha's teaching or in following the Buddha's teaching. The first step is always to go for refuge to the three jewels. The second step is to take the five precepts. But now Ananda goes further and he says, it is owing to the Blessed One that Gotami possesses unwavering confidence in the Buddha, in the Dhamma, in the Sangha, and that she possesses the virtues loved by the noble ones. And here we come across an important expression that indicates, we call this the spiritual level at which Gotami stands when this sutta takes place. The expression here is avaja prasad. Okay, the expression avaja prasada indicates the confidence of one who has reached at least the stage of a stream enterer. The expression here, avaja, which is translated unwavering, actually comes from a verb which I don't think occurs on its own in the text. Avaiti, which means to undergo, to experience. So avaja prasada is confidence, the confidence of one who has undergone the decisive experience of seeing into the truth of the Dhamma. And so it's said that the stream enterer has this unwavering or unbreakable confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and then also possesses what are called the virtues dear to the noble ones or loved by the noble ones. And these are explained in the commentary as the five precepts that become, let's say, fixed traits of character in the noble disciple. Sometimes the question comes up, is it possible for a noble disciple to break any of the five precepts? This is my own understanding, that while a noble disciple is living in this life, they won't break any of the five precepts. But I don't recall any sutta that says that the noble disciple can, that it's impossible for the noble disciple to break the five precepts. So the thought occurs to me, perhaps it's possible that somebody becomes a stream enterer, so they still have several more lives as a human being, or could have several more lives as a human being. So this person gets reborn, they're a child, and maybe as a child playing around, they might take the life of an insect or might tell a little lie. But once they reach the age of maturity and come to understand, at that point they'll understand that they have actually reached the stage of a stream enterer or a higher stage in a previous life. And then those five precepts will immediately come up and they will adopt them as their natural behavior. But I think the commentarial tradition is that the stream enterer never breaks the five precepts. But whether that's so or not, I don't know. Okay, then it said, it is owing to the Blessed One that Maha Prajapati Gotami is free from doubt or perplexity or confusion about dukkha or suffering, about the origin of dukkha, about the cessation of dukkha, about the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. In other words, that she has no doubt at all about the Four Noble Truths. And the reason that she has no doubt at all about the Four Noble Truths is because as one who is at minimum a stream enterer, she has seen directly, you know, with experiential insight, she has seen the Four Noble Truths. And so one of the three fetters which is eradicated by the stream enterer is in fact doubt. Doubt about the Four Noble Truths. So by saying all this, especially by saying that Maha Prajapati has this unwavering, unbreakable confidence in the three jewels, that she possesses those virtues loved by the noble ones, that she is free from doubt about the Four Noble Truths, Ananda is indicating that it's through the Buddha that Maha Prajapati has become at least the stream enterer. Okay, but what's interesting here is that, and this to my mind indicates where this sutta will stand on a chronological scale, two things would be missing that one would expect. Let's say, what are the two things that one would expect if the sutta took place later in the Buddha's teaching career regarding Maha Prajapati? I'm not sure if I phrased the question well. Okay, let me not phrase a question, but put it as a statement. If the sutta took place at the time Maha Prajapati had become a bhikkhuni, then Ananda would say it's owing to the Blessed One, despite all his resistance, he was the one who still opened up the door. It's owing to the Blessed One that Maha Prajapati has become a bhikkhuni, or that she's received monastic ordination. And then another sutta says, very soon after Maha Prajapati received bhikkhuni ordination, she achieved arhatship. And so, if the sutta took place at that later point, it would say it's owing to the Blessed One that Maha Prajapati has achieved arhatship, or that her mind has been liberated from all defilements, or that she has eliminated the 10 fetters, or something like that. But it stops at the level of somebody who might be a stream enterer or once returner. Okay, then when Ananda says this, then the Buddha confirms it and then says that when owing to one person, another person has gone for refuge to the three jewels, undertakes the five precepts, gains unwavering confidence in the three, in the triple gem, and becomes free from doubt about the Four Noble Truths, then it is not easy for that person to repay the other by paying homage, rising up, salutation, polite services, and providing robes, alms, food, rest, dwelling places, and medicinal requisites. Okay, any questions at this point? Any questions, comments? Well, I thought I was touching on some controversial issues here. Okay, Terry.
This is just out of curiosity.
Yeah.
Why does Buddha have to be guarded four times and finally he agrees to the request from Ananda?
Yeah, I can speak a little bit.
Why does Buddha have to be...
Yeah, speak.
Why does Buddha have to be asked four times and then finally agrees?
To Ananda's request?
Yes, for Ananda.
This is what comes up in that, the account of that particular incident, which to my mind raises some questions. Okay, after the Buddha has laid down these eight conditions, and then Mahaprajapati accepts them, then the Buddha tells Ananda, I know this is going to be offensive to women, and I don't like the passage either. And I have questions about it also. He says that if women had not achieved the going forth, you know, the ordination in this teaching, then the brahmacharya, the holy life, the spiritual life, would have lasted a full 1,000 years. But because women have received the going forth into this teaching, now the holy life will last 500 years. Okay, what strikes me as peculiar about this passage is that if the Buddha is concerned to preserve the spiritual life, you know, for its full lifespan, he should have told that to Ananda when Ananda was insisting on the ordination. Why mention it at the end? You know, after the ordination is over, the process of ordination has already started. And don't forget, we have to not forget that the texts have been compiled through a process of first oral transmission, and there's room for a lot of, I have to say, for tinkering and manipulation by monks who are resentful of the ordination of women. Yes, Michael.
Yes.
Please take the microphone.
Sure. Is this good? Is it on?
It's on, but it makes... Yeah.
Okay. In the Mahayana Sutra, known as the Gotami Sutra, there's a lot of discussion about the nature of women as opposed to the nature of men. It's clearly stated that women cannot control their emotions, unlike men, and therefore there was a lot of discussion about whether or not women should receive the going forth. Is there anything like that at all, or anything of that nature to be found in the Pali canon?
That women cannot control their emotions, unlike men who can control their emotions?
Exactly. I know that sounds very strange. Well, of course, most people find it offensive. But
yeah, where is this Gotami Mahayana Sutra found?
Well, it's from the... I have a copy in English,
yeah.
And I'll bring it to you. but and I can't give you any more detail about it.
It's published as a separate sutra or in an anthology?
Yes, it is.
As a separate sutra?
Exactly. It hasn't been translated. To my knowledge, it was translated into English very recently. Mm.
Since I have the Samyutta Nikaya right up on the table, there's a short Samyutta called Connected Discourses on Women. I want to see, because my memory is not as good as it used to be, whether there is such a sutra. Actually, there. Come to think of it, it's not in the Samyutta. There are some suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya. I think it's the Book of Fives, which makes some, I have to say, some derogatory, really denigrating, harsh statements about women ascribed to the Buddha. But I just have so much question about those suttas, because, as I said, it's just so easy for, say, for misogynist monks to insert little suttas into a collection like that. Like one of them, if I can, if you don't get up and promise you won't get up and walk out on, it's called The Black Snake. It says that there's something like, there are these five qualities of a black snake, within it mentions some of the bad qualities of a black snake, and then it says that there are these five qualities of women, comparing them to, in which, these five respects in which a woman is similar to the black snake. Like, she's vicious, full of venom, so that they're up. You're crying.
She got 10 qualities.
One is, okay, vicious, treacherous, poisonous, things like that. Yeah, so there are little suttas like that, but as I said, one could see how they could be slipped in. On the whole, apart from little suttas like that, I don't recall any statements like that women can't control their emotions, but men can. And when somebody tells me that men can control their emotions, I say, just look at the news. Who is responsible? Not laughing matters, but like things like, do we see women suicide bombers going into Paris and setting off their bodies to kill 130 people? Well, I have to go backtrack on that, because the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka and over in India did use female suicide bombers, but probably because they were instigated to go by men. Matt, did you have your hand up?
Yes, I don't understand why the Buddha says it's not easy to just for the former to repay the latter when you would think that.
You speak in a loud voice. I could hear you, and then I'll repeat the question.
It's not easy to repay the Buddha when he's illuminated you on the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah, okay, so the question is, why does the sutta say that it isn't easy to repay one who has introduced one to the Dhamma and taught one the Four Noble Truths and so on? The point is that one who introduces one to the three refuges, the five precepts and so on, the Four Noble Truths, does a very great benefit to the other person. And so the material gifts or the visible signs of reverence that the recipient might give to the donor as well as the material gifts that they might give, are not equivalent in value to the gift of the Dhamma that the benefactor gives to the other person. Okay, I want to move on in the sutta, unless anybody has any other urgent questions. Okay, now comes an enumeration of what are called kinds. The sutta is going to make a distinction between two kinds of offerings, what are called personal offerings. These are offerings given to somebody as an individual, of which there will be 14 kinds mentioned, and then there will be what are called, we use the Pali word sanghika dana. These are gifts given, designated not to an individual, but to the sangha as a communal or collective whole. Okay, so we come, the 14 are sort of arranged as a kind of hierarchy, we call this, in descending order, so that one gives a gift to the Tathagata. Then, that's the Tathagata, is the Buddha. One gives a gift to a Pacheka Buddha. A Pacheka Buddha is sometimes, the expression is sometimes translated, an individual enlightened one. A Pacheka Buddha is somebody who achieves enlightenment during a period when the Buddha's teaching is not known, not disseminated in the world. So the Pacheka Buddhas are depicted as living somewhat reclusive, ascetic lives, and then realizing on their own the truth of the Dhamma, but they don't make the attempt to propagate the Dhamma in the world, but they preserve their realization within themselves. Okay, then comes the gift to an arahat disciple. Then this is interesting for one who knows sort of the technicalities of the Dhamma. One gives a gift to one who has entered upon the way to the realization of the fruit of arhatship. Let me go through the whole list, then I'll come to the interesting point about this. Okay, one gives a gift to a non-returner. One gives a gift to one who is practicing the way to realization of the fruit of non-return. One gives a gift to a once-returner. One gives a gift to one who is on the way to realizing the fruit of the once-returner. One gives a gift to a stream-enterer. One gives a gift to one who has entered upon the way to realization of the fruit of stream entry. Okay, now there's an interesting problem here. What is the problem? We need our doctrinal specialist to come up with the problem. Poe, do you see a little problem there?
Because at a second, those people who are on the path, actually the three levels, theoretically do not exist according to the Abhidhamma.
Yeah, this is the problem. According to the Abhidhamma and commentarial understanding, what is meant by one who is on the way to realization is one who has achieved the magga or path. And the path is supposed to be one mind moment of realization, the one mind moment in which one penetrates the Four Noble Truths. And so if the path is just one mind moment, and the one who is on the way to the fruit of stream entry, once return, non-return, arhatship, if that is the one at that path moment, how do you make the gift to one who exists just for one fleeting mind moment? So the commentary sort of feels a little embarrassed by this, and it tries to explain it that somebody is making an offering, say, to the monk, and they put the food in the alms bowl, and just as the food, say, hits the bottom of the alms bowl, that monk has the realization of the Four Noble Truths. And so, for that one mind moment, they are receiving the gift. But of course, that goes against, you know, common sense. And I think we have to understand this from the standpoint of common sense. So the way I would understand this is that this is a gift to one who is really practicing earnestly for the attainment of the corresponding fruit. Even though that course of practice might culminate in one moment of realization, but one could still describe the person as practicing or on the way to realization of the fruit, even while they're continuing maybe for days and weeks and months, even years of earnest practice. Okay, then one. Okay, so that's the 10th personal gift. Then one gives a gift to one outside. This is called one outside the dispensation, who is free from lust for sensual pleasures. This is an expression for one who has achieved the jhanas or the formless meditative absorptions. Okay, then one gives a gift to a virtuous ordinary person, that is to one who has not reached any realization, probably not yet reached even the jhanas, but who has virtuous qualities and is practicing. I say this is probably intending, and it's a little unclear whether it intends a virtuous ordinary person to be any ordinary person, or one who is within the Buddha's teaching, but is not yet reached any stage of realization. Okay, then one gives a gift to an immoral ordinary person, and then one gives a gift to an animal. So that's the 14 kinds of personal offerings. And I have to again confess a little bit at the outset, I have some doubts about some things in the sutta. I could see numerous little problems with it. One thing is the unclarity whether the virtuous ordinary person is somebody, you know, on the street who's observing an ethical life, or whether it's referring specifically to somebody, say, within the Buddha's teaching who's undertaken the five precepts. And then the same with the immoral ordinary person. Does this mean somebody on the outside who's just living an immoral life? Or is it referring to somebody who is within the Buddha's teaching? Particularly, probably, the indication would be an immoral monk. Okay, then if we take it in the narrow sense, the virtuous ordinary person, the immoral person, as being the virtuous and immoral ordinary people within the Buddha's teaching, then what happens about all of the virtuous people and immoral people outside the Buddha's teaching? They wouldn't be covered. Okay, then I find still a little more problem coming with the next paragraph. Okay, by giving a gift to an animal, the offering may be expected to repay 100-fold. That is, the merit is going to come back in good results 100 times the value of the gift. Okay, by giving to an immoral, ordinary person, the offering repays 1,000-fold. To a virtuous, ordinary person, the offering may be expected to repay 100,000-fold. By giving the gift to one outside who is free from lust for sensual pleasures, the offering may be expected to repay 100,000 times, 100,000-fold. By giving a gift to one who has entered upon the way to stream entry, the offering may be expected to repay incalculably, immeasurably, and then it's immeasurable, incalculable, all the ways up to the Tathagata, the fully enlightened one. okay, I hope I'm not going to be called up to the authorities in Colombo or Rangoon or Bangkok for some of these queries, but it seems to me suspicious, you know, the way these merits are calculated with such mathematical precision. You know, 100-fold, 1,000-fold, 100,000-fold. You know, that seems somewhat problematic to me. You know, that one could calculate precisely the amount of merits that's coming from the gift to this kind of person, that kind of person. Yeah.
In the most general sense, this is the style of many of the Mahayana sutras. The Lotus Sutra gives us a lot of different kinds of increases.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Dhyana Sutra as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So does this indicate that there's an influence here, or
I would,
that it's from a later period, perhaps?
I would doubt that there was an influence from the Mahayana on this, because I think my conjecture is that the sutta was probably formalized in some kind of fixed form before the actual rise of the Mahayana. But it seems to have that little bit of that flavor, that kind of way of thinking that becomes embodied much more expansively and in much greater detail in the Mahayana sutras. And also something I find a little problematic here is that the idea of giving is always conceptualized in terms of giving in order to acquire merit as some kind of feedback or benefit coming back to oneself. And there's the idea that the act of giving is always conceptualized in terms of a religiously or spiritually worthy act. And so one doesn't have a conception here of giving to what I call the poor, the unfortunate, the needy. And I found the antidote to this in a Mahayana sutra, which has come down in China. The conjecture is that it's a compilation, probably based on older Indian sources. I just took some notes on that before the class. This sutra, called the Upasika Sila Sutra, the precepts or the virtue of a lay follower, distinguishes two fields of giving. One is called the field of merits, which, or the field of the venerable, or the field of reverence, we could call it, and then the field of the needy. And so it says that then it uses pairs of qualities that are to be developed by giving to these two respective fields of gifts. So to increase virtue, it says, one gives to the poor. To increase wisdom, one gives to the field of reverence. Out of gratitude, one gives to the field of reverence. And out of compassion, one gives to the needy. To abandon defilements, one gives to the field of reverence. To perfect virtuous qualities, one gives to the poor. To increase happiness, one gives to the field of reverence. To relieve suffering, one gives to the poor. And so to my mind, that passage brings in a certain balance, which I find absent from this sutta. Okay, let us continue so that this time is running out and I want to finish the sutta. Okay, so these are the gifts to individuals, gifts that are designated to individuals. Now come the seven kinds of offerings made to the Sangha. Okay, first, one gives a gift to what is called the Ubuddho Sangha. This is the Sangha of both, and that is a stock expression used to indicate a Sangha with both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. So a Sangha of both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis headed by the Buddha. And we can see here why I say that there's an anachronism in the sutta. What is the anachronism? Pretty obvious.
Well, clearly that he mentions bhikkhunis here, but before Parami he's here.
Yeah, exactly. It mentions bhikkhunis, whereas the beginning of the sutta, the protagonist is Mahaprajapati Gotami, and from all indications, as I said, she's still a laywoman. So something is wrong. Either this is a later passage which has come in, which is quite conceivable. You know, after the Bhikkhuni Sangha arose, there could have been an older sutta that was then modified to take account of the existence of bhikkhunis. Either that, or the story about Mahaprajapati as being the first bhikkhuni, that could also be legendary. You know, perhaps there were just ordinary women came and asked to become bhikkhunis, and somehow bhikkhuni ordination started. Then to sort of glorify the origins of the bhikkhuni sangha by connecting it to the Sakyan family, Mahaprajapati gets cast in the role of the first bhikkhuni. No, we don't know, because all of this is taking place, what, 2,500 years ago? And the text probably, you know, emerged over, despite the legend of the first council, but the texts, as they've come down, probably emerged over a period of, you know, 150 years, perhaps. Okay, so then we have, that's the first gift to the Sangha. Then a second is a gift to the Sangha, both Sanghas, after the Buddha has attained Parinibbana. Again, that sort of indicates a bit that it's could be later, not necessarily, but it could be later. And so what's in standard procedure in a country like Sri Lanka, when people are giving an offering to the Sangha, they don't like the Buddha to be absent, and so what is done is to bring relics of the Buddha enshrined in a casket and set them up on the altar. And so then when one is offering the gift to the Sangha, one offers it to the Buddha and to the Sangha, the Buddha represented by the relics in the casket and by the image, the statue of the Buddha. Okay, so that's the second. The third is okay, one gives a gift to the Sangha only of bhikkhus, then one gives a gift to a Sangha only of bhikkhunis. That is where one just invites bhikkhus or bhikkhunis in general to come for an alms offering. The next cases is where one says appoint so many bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, that is, one says, one has like a limited alms offering, send 5 bhikkhus, 5 bhikkhunis. Then the next one says appoint so many bhikkhus, and the next one, the last one, appoint so many bhikkhunis to come. So the 5, so in this case one say appoint 5 bhikkhus, appoint 5 bhikkhunis. Each one is taken to represent the whole Sangha. Okay, then we come to a rather perplexing passage. In future times, there will be members of the clan, and here the term used is gotrabhu, who are yellow necks. I didn't look up the Pali expression for that before I came here. I think it's kasava kanta. That is, they have the saffron strip or saffron cloak around the neck. Immoral, of evil character. People who give gifts to these immoral persons, for the sake of the Sangha, that is, taking them to represent the Sangha, even then I say an offering made to the Sangha is incalculable, immeasurable, and I say that in no way is a gift to a person individually ever more fruitful than an offering made to the Sangha. Okay, then the commentary, I have a note from the commentary, says that a gift offered to an immoral monk taken to represent the entire Sangha is more fruitful than a gift offered on a personal basis to an arahant. Okay, but then this is what the commentary says, but for the gift to be properly presented to the Sangha, the donor must take no account of the personal qualities of the recipient, but must see him solely as representing the Sangha as a whole. Okay, Venerable Analeo, in his comparative study, if I understand him correctly, he says that the Chinese parallel to the sutta speaks about that monk not as one who's evil and immoral, but as a lazy monk, one who is not initiating energy. Okay, this passage again I find perplexing and somewhat problematic. Okay, we have evil, immoral monks, or even lazy, let's say lazy, negligent monks. Okay, what is done, the tradition in Sri Lanka is not to choose lazy, immoral, or lazy monks, but one invites monks from the temple or the monastery for a sangha, and then one makes it in the mind as what's called a sanghika dana. So it says, imang bhikkhang bhikkhu sanghasa dema. So these offering items we offer to the Bhikkhu Sangha, and the way the monks explain this is that when you make it a Sanghika Dana, an offering to the Sangha, then one is giving it to the entire Sangha that has existed from the time of Sariputta, Moggallana, Mahakasapa, Ananda. All of those are included in your intention of giving this gift. So even though you have like ordinary monks sitting there, you know, who are just performing the rituals in the temple, let's leave aside the immoral monks, but say they're good monks, but just not monks who haven't achieved any level of realization, but just performing the routine duties of a monk. But by thinking, I'm making this offering to the whole Sangha through all historical time, then it becomes a Sanghika Dana, an offering designated to the whole Sangha, and is supposed to generate a great incalculable mass of merit. You know, I don't have the divine eye, so I can't see how much merit is being generated, but I just find it problematic, the idea that, okay, after these great Arahat monks have passed away, and one is making the offerings to the Sangha represented by individual monks. You know, say one has 10 monks from the nearby temple or monastery. Can they really represent the whole Sangha coming from the time of the Buddha all the ways down the centuries? This I don't know, but I just find it difficult to believe that somebody making a Sanghika Dana to the Sangha in the Buddha's time, with those monks like Sariputta, Moggallana, Ananda, Mahakasapa there, will be generating the same kind of merit that comes from somebody who makes it in the offering in 2015 to the monks at Sri Bodhi Rama Temple in Kandy, Sri Lanka. Does it work that way? I don't know. Okay, Maybe I'll ask now whether there are any questions or comments. What do you think about some of this? Yeah. I'm a bit worried whether the doubts I'm expressing.
Hold this. I've always been troubled myself. I've always been troubled myself by this whole idea of motivation and intention as it's reflected in merit. It seems to me that somehow the spirit and the letter. I'm having trouble differentiating between the spirit and the letter here. If the spirit of giving is, first of all, impersonal, the act of giving and losing the feeling that the person receiving the gift is worthy or unworthy or higher or lower, but it becomes a process of the object and the subject becoming one, a kind of a oneness identified in the gift. In other words, if we understand that there is no self.
Yeah.
There's no self to give to, and there's no self to give from. So we try to meditate on those ideas maybe before giving the gift. And I know I'm rambling, forgive me. Yeah. But this whole idea of merit, I'm doing this because I want something good to come back to me, or I expect something good to come back to me, is troubling.
Yeah.
And I find it very difficult to feel it and to understand it.
Yeah, I have to say, I share to some extent those same kind of scruples or concerns. Except I would say that I do think it's important to be generating merits in order to provide what I would call a foundation of wholesome karma to secure oneself as long as one is going to migrate within the cycle of birth and death to secure oneself favorable conditions for one's next existence. One wouldn't want to be reborn if one comes back into the human world, into a country which is torn by war, conflict, extreme poverty, extreme climate crises, and so forth. And then also accumulating merits provides a foundation for one's spiritual progress in the practice. So in that sense, I could see the value of the concept of merit. What troubles me is the idea that one sort of starts evaluating persons. Is this one worthy of a worthy field of merit? Is that one? And since in this particular schema that I mentioned here, there's, when you look at, say, poor people, you know, they don't come to the qualification, generally probably not, of being a stream enter on the way to stream entry. So one thinks, so they're less worthy of gifts than those who are, you know, practicing earnestly. And so that leads to a neglect of, you know, the poor and the unfortunate. In this way, I have to say, from this standpoint, there's so much in Christianity that I disagree with, but I take to heart the saying of Jesus, those who do it to the least among them do it unto me.
I wonder, too, if I can add one little thing, that the last stanza of the verse in paragraph 14 uses the word passionless. And I wonder if that reflects something of what we're talking about. On page 11.
This is probably, I think this is probably coming from Nyanamoli's original translation. I think it's Vitaraga, one who is devoid of raga or lust. So this is actually speaking about, so when a passionless person gives with a trusting heart a gift righteously obtained, placing faith that the fruit of action is great, that gift, I say, is the best of worldly gifts. So this is said to be a gift that one arhat might give to another arhat. But that gift is not generating any merit because the arhat is finished with creating merit. So the point here is that you know, that a gift that doesn't generate any merit because it's coming from an arhat is the best of gifts. But you were suggesting that this might be seen in the light of what you, the point that you were making before?
In the light.
Where you're...
In the light of the spirit in which the gift is giving, one could say in the light of the arhat spirit, perhaps, or in the light of the more objective or perhaps less personalized.
Anyway, we can just look at the verses after lunch, because now the time has run out. So I didn't get to cover everything in the sutta. But after lunch, we'll come back and we'll look at the last section and the verses. Okay, so now we do the sharing. One of the points in acquiring merit is that one is not supposed to sort of grasp onto it and think this is mine. But when one acquires the merit, one is supposed to invite other beings to rejoice in it. And in that way, one shares the merit with others. And so we'll end with sharing the merits to the Dhamma-protecting deities, the fear spirits, and all other beings. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantam Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantam Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantam Anumoditva Shirang Rakantu Mam Param Etavatacham Hehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Devanumodantu Sabe Bhutanumodantu Sabe Satanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Bhavagupadaya Vichihetato Etantare Satakayupapana Rupiya Rupicha Asanya Sanino Dukha Pamuchantu Pusantu Nibhutin. Okay, we could come back, say, 12:30. And just bear in mind that next week, because there'll be a retreat going on here, so there won't be a class. So the next class will be December 5th. And then we'll do... start to get into the sixfold base. We'll start with 143. Maybe I'll try to do 143 and 145 in one day. Okay, so we end with three half bows to the Buddha.
Thank you.